Well, we're not far from the spring holiday season. It seems only a few weeks ago that we were just at the Feast of Tabernacles. Hasn't been that long, it feels like. But we're rounding the bend and headed towards the Passover season, as well as the Days of Unleavened Bread. Well, today I'd like to review with you the journey of primarily one person in the Bible. I'll give you a little bit of a trivia point here. See if you kids can figure this out, because you probably can. This person is mentioned over 800 times in the Bible and over 80 times in the New Testament, even though their events are primarily recorded in the Old Testament. Probably have a couple of guesses. I'll give you the gender. He is the most mentioned Old Testament figure, again, in the New Testament, and his trivia revolves around the number 10. Number 10. So it's not Abraham, it's not David, you might have guessed, it's Moses. So today I'd like to talk about Moses and walk along with Moses. The title of my message actually is Walking with Moses, and highlight the lessons and the learnings from his journey. You can go ahead and begin to turn to Exodus, because that's where we'll be pretty much the entire message today. Moses had a unique vantage point in that his journey and his learnings were pretty much mostly recorded from when he was a child all the way up through really his activities with the Israelites, and then, of course, the challenges that he would go through. But what's interesting is that he witnessed in this journey many miracles along the way. It also was some of the prophecies that came about with him that would then foreshadow the future king. The future King of Kings. Actually, the individual, the person, the God he was speaking to was Jesus Christ, who would eventually become the eventual sacrificial lamb. And we'll see that foreshadowed as we walk through Exodus. So turn over to Exodus if you haven't already. And I don't know about your Bible, but mine at the beginning of chapters usually has a summary around the location, what the chapter is about. I just want to read you an excerpt of that from my Bible. It says, Exodus is the record of Israel's birth as a nation. With the protective womb of Egypt, the Israelite family of what began as about 70 rapidly multiplied. At the right time, accompanied with severe birth pains, an infant nation numbering between 2 and 3 million people is brought into the world where it is divinely protected, fed, and nurtured. That was the summary from my New King James Bible. What I want to do is walk us through 10 steps, you might say, 10 steps that Moses took of lessons that we can learn. And the first step along that path is that God protects those who obey him. Seems like a simple point, but I think you'll see that comes out as a strong theme. God protects those who obey him. Let's start in Exodus 1, and let's begin in verse 15. It says, then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on their birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God. It did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. Can you imagine being a Hebrew midwife and being told by your captor, you will kill all male babies that you see born? Verse 18, so the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? So they weren't following his instruction. And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, so here's a shot at the Egyptian women, apparently, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. So before we can get there, there's a baby. And it just so happens that they seem stronger than the Egyptian women, can give birth faster. Now certainly that was probably a form maybe of an excuse, maybe it wasn't. Maybe they were more fit. Verse 20, therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. which is not what Pharaoh wanted. Pharaoh was focused on a form of genocide. He wanted to hold down the Israelites. And it said in verse 21, "And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them." He protected them. He took care of them because they were obeying God and feared him and respected him more than Pharaoh. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." So a situation that, quite frankly, is horrific, because I'm sure there were cases when this did happen, when the Egyptians would see a male baby or toddler and they would commit that act. It was a very sad situation for carnality, for that matter. Pharaoh clearly wanted to commit this form of genocide and hold down the Israelites and kill all the male babies. But God was there protecting them for the most part. And the Israel nation grew despite what Pharaoh was trying to accomplish. The second step along the path: we have to sacrifice now to be rewarded later. We have to sacrifice now to be rewarded later. Now, that's not to say that, as the old adage goes, you have to eat your veggies before you can have your dessert. But it is a matter of knowing that in this world we live in, just in a similar sense, while we are in captivity with Satan as the ruler of this world, we are waiting for a greater time, a greater future, a greater kingdom. Similarly, the captivity of the Israelites, where they were being held down by the Egyptians for what was centuries, they were waiting for a greater time as well. In Exodus 2, verse 2, here, moving along here in Exodus, we see that in verse 2, "So the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months." So 3 months Moses' mother hid him. "But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch to make it waterproof, put the child in it, laid it in the reeds by the river's bank, and his sister stood afar off." Moses' sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. She wanted to watch to see what was going to happen. "And then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to go to get it." There's this, you know, this basket floating along in the river by where she was bathing. Potentially the baby was crying. It doesn't say. "And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept." So we see that it was crying when they opened the basket. "So she had compassion on this baby, on him, and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.'" So she recognized it was not an Egyptian child. So we know that much. "And then his sister, Moses' sister, to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?'" So we see God's hand is already coming into play. Now, this is the critical point. What will she say? "And Pharaoh's daughter said, 'To go.'" Yes, go get this maiden. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. "And then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages.' So the woman took the child and nursed him." So we see a pretty interesting turn of events. The potential of losing her child, Moses, to the events changing to actually be able to nurse and raise her own child, but under the protection of Pharaoh's daughter and Pharaoh's house. In verse 10, "And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, 'Because I drew him out of the water.'" So here we begin to see God's hand in Moses' life. Step along the path number 3. Someone is always watching. Someone is always watching. And you'll recognize the phrase when we say it, but you might remember the phrase when you were growing up, "Who made you boss?" When something goes wrong, well, who made you boss? Well, being the oldest son, I would always say, "Well, I did. I made myself boss." That didn't always go over well, though. Exodus 2, verse 11. says, "Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown." So Moses is a mature man at this point. "That he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and he looked that way. And when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian. And he hid him in the sand." He tried to cover up the murder that had just happened. We see in verse 13, "And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting," two of his brethren. He saw them fighting. "And he said to one of them, who did the wrong? Why are you striking your companion? And then he said, who made you," one of the individuals that was fighting, "who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Well, that got his attention. So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known. Surely everyone knows what I've done. It's only been a day, and my Egyptian brethren know the fact that I killed one of the Egyptians." And when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. Certainly Pharaoh knew of Moses. He knew he was a son of his daughters or had been adopted. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So Moses ran away. He knew his life was in danger because he had killed and murdered an Egyptian. So he was in a difficult place. He was kind of between, you could say, these two nations in a way. To summarize verse 16 through 22, we see Moses now meets his future wife, Zipporah. So he meets his wife, he's been given a wife, and he's going to dwell in the land of Midian. In Exodus 2, verse 23, says, "Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died." So the king that had been there, the Pharaoh, who was, you know, putting the Israelites in bondage, had passed away. "Yet then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of their bondage." So there was no relenting in the bondage of the Israelites from the new Pharaoh. And we'll see that he was probably even tougher or harder on the Israelites here shortly. Verse 24, "So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them." He saw what they were going through and was now going to do something about it. Number four, the fourth step along the path for Moses that was a learning point, is that God has plans for us. We must let him lead us. God has plans for us, but we must let him lead us. It's not always easy to do. And chapter 3, verse 1 says, "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro." So Jethro is his father-in-law. Moses is now in a very rural area. He's tending a flock as a shepherd, ironically. And he's living his life. He's got a family now. He's away from the Egyptians and that bondage. It says here, going on in verse 1, "And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God," or what was Mount Sinai. So he's been there for decades, Moses, living away from the Egyptians, probably thinking that that is a former chapter in his life he'll never have to go back to. Well, little did he know, God had zoomed in on him for this opportunity. In Exodus 3, verse 2, let's go there. "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed." This bush was on fire, but was probably still green and leafy and was not perishing. Certainly a miracle to behold. Then Moses said, he was going to look at it. He wanted to behold this sight. "I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn." This had to be just a crazy thing to even for him to see. "So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. He's realizing the magnitude of this situation. This is God that is coming to him in a voice in this miracle of a burning bush. The Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land. This to a land of flowing with milk and honey. That then is a matter of that was going to be the goal for the Israelites. We know that they struggled with that in the wilderness for 40 years, obviously, to eventually get to that place. But this was the plan that was prophesied. In verse 9 it says, Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. That might be where Moses' jaw dropped. Because now he's engaged with God in a conversation to go back to the land he fled from, where he was a murderer, to this giant nation that had held captive the Israelites for so long. He says it. Verse 11. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? I'm just a man. How am I going to do that? I don't have any power. So he said, I will certainly be with you. And this shall be a sign that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain where we are right now. We will come back to, and you will be here to serve those people. And I can almost visualize Moses just saying, I don't know. I don't want to do this. Moses showed humility, though. He did not show pride. He didn't say, oh, yeah, I'll go back. We'll whip those Egyptians. No, that's not how he approached it. And just as Moses was to bring the Israelites out of Egypt, we too are in a very similar situation where we are to be coming out of this world. We are in a captive place. Satan is currently the ruler of this nation or of this world. But we know we must be ambassadors. We must separate ourselves from the way of this world, just as the Israelites were to begin to separate themselves from Egypt. And we'll definitely see that as we go through the plagues. There's a very clear line that's created there. The step along the path, number 5. God's hand is all-powerful, but in his own time. God's hand is all-powerful, but in his own time. Moving along here in chapter 3 in verse 18, we see, Then they will heed your voice, and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt. Here prophesying what would happen. And you shall say to them, The Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us. And now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. So this was going to be the request of Pharaoh to give the Israelites 3 days to worship their God. And he was prophesying that that would happen when he approached Pharaoh. In verse 20, so I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all wonders. Because in the verse before, he talks about the fact that the king of Egypt would not relent. He knows his heart would be hardened. All my wonders, which I will do in its midst, and after that he will let you go. So God's prophesying of the eventual relenting of the Egyptian king. But notice, he's not describing to Moses all the things he would have to go through to make that happen. Well, it can be very difficult for us today to show patience and endurance through the trials that we have to go through. God doesn't always answer our prayers in the timeline that we have in our own minds. And typically that's because there's a lesson to be learned, something that we need to apply in our life, a character opportunity. For some, pain ends quickly, and a health issue, physical, mental. For others, it can last for decades. For some, it's a lifetime of pain. And that's That is very upsetting. That is certainly a situation that fortunately I've not had to deal with, but there are some that do. But the eventual reward of God's kingdom and his family will be worth the wait. Be worth the wait, because it's in God's time that we will be blessed. Step number six along the path. Step number six. Three miracles and Moses still had doubts. Three miracles and Moses still had doubts. Chapter 4, verse 1. Then Moses answered and said, "But suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say the Lord has not appeared to you." So what if they call my bluff and God, you're not behind me, showing them that I am truly appointed by you? So Moses is doubting God here. And as we know, the Lord here is speaking of Jesus Christ, part of the God family. And so they go on to say in verse 2, "So the Lord said to him, 'What is that in your hand? What is that in your hand?' He said, 'A rod.' And he said, 'Cast it on the ground.' So he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent." It became a snake. Now at that point, Moses was probably about ready to run away, as many of you probably would have done, because this rod turns into this snake. And at that point then he says, verse 4, "Now reach out your hand and take the tail of the snake." And he reached out his hand and he caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. It went back from a snake to a rod. Okay, can you picture that happening? "That they may believe," in verse 5, "that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to you." So here's a proof. I'm showing you a miracle. Okay, you're not convinced. Verse 6, "Furthermore, the Lord said to him, 'Now put your hand in your bosom.' And he put his hand in his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous." It was leprous, like snow. And he said, "Put your hand in your bosom again." So he put his hand in his bosom and drew it out of his bosom, and behold, it was restored like his other flesh. So it went from the white leprous to back to the fleshy color. So now this is the second miracle that he's showing him. I am your God. I will help you. And then it will be, if they do not believe you after the second sign, nor heed the message of the first sign, that they may believe the message of the latter sign, and it shall be, if they do not believe even these two signs, or listen to your voice, that you shall take water from the river, pour it on dry land, and the water which you take from the river will become blood on the dry land. So three signs, three miracles. And even after that, Moses insists and argues with God, angers God, and God relents to give Moses Aaron as his spokesperson. So we see there was some, we'll call it negotiation in that process. God had a goal to bring the Israelites out of captivity, and he was trying to work with Moses to move him along the path, to lead the conversation per se as a leader. But Aaron would be a part with him, almost like a lieutenant, his cohort. Now, Moses and Aaron go to Egypt. So chapter 4 and verse 29. Chapter 4 and verse 29. We see, "Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel." So they're in Egypt. They're now meeting with the Israelites and the elders of the Israelites. "And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people." So they perform the three miracles to show the Israelites that God is with them. Verse 31, "So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel and that he had looked on their affliction, then they bowed their heads and they worshiped." They saw and they believed that God was there to save them. Moses and Aaron would then meet with Pharaoh and ask that he would release the Israelites again for the 3 days to worship God, perform sacrifices. And guess what? He denied them. He denied them. Instead of making it easier on them, he now makes it worse on the Israelites. Let's look at Exodus 5 and verse 6. Exodus 5 and verse 6, it says, "So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, You shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. So now, where the Egyptians had been supplying them their inventory of straw to make their quota of bricks, Pharaoh says, nah, no more. They're going to go get their own straw, they're going to make their bricks, and they're going to make the same quota. That's what I'll do to them, to spite them and this ask to be separated. And it says, it goes on in verse 8, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before, and you shall not reduce it. You will not relent. So how often do we have a trial? We think life is, oh, how much harder can it get? And then here comes another trial, right on top of that trial. And so often we're challenged to stretch a little further in that we need to draw closer to God. And similarly, Pharaoh was challenging the Israelites. He's wanting to break them. He's wanting to break them. In verse 20 it says, then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. So the Israelites come out probably after a terrible day of work, of labor, and they say in verse 21, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us aberrant in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. So the Israelites, they're saying, what have you done, Moses and Aaron? You have not only come here, you have basically gotten in the face of Pharaoh. You've challenged him. He's now made our lives worthless, almost. This comment of Pharaoh now basically loathes us. He hates us. He's disgusted by us, and he's making our life miserable. And oh, by the way, they're the ones with the swords, and they can kill us. So you can kind of see their side of the argument. Again, Moses has to be the leader. He is working with God. He had to stand fast. I'm sure he had doubts at times, but God had chosen him to perform this work. Step number 7 along the path for Moses, one of the learnings. God's power always trumps Satan and man's power. God's power always trumps Satan and man's power. Exodus 7 now. And verse 8. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, show a miracle for yourselves, then you shall say to Aaron, take your rod and cast it before Pharaoh, and let it become a serpent. So here again, we see the rod becoming a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh, and they did so, just as the Lord commanded, and Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. But Pharaoh also called, Pharaoh's thinking, we can do that. We can turn rods into serpents, no problem. The Pharaoh calls his wise men, the sorcerers, to the magicians. So the magicians of Egypt, they also didn't like manner with their enchantments. So Moses is being supported with the miracles from God. Undoubtedly, these sorcerers have Satan in their corner, and they've got things they're trying to perform, and they're able to turn their rods into serpents. In verse 12, but I'm sure to their disgust, but Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. So here, Aaron's snake basically eats the other snakes to say, nope, you're not more powerful than God, the Eternal. And now we see Pharaoh's heart again grow hard. In verse 13, and he did not heed them. In other words, he didn't relent to their ask for the Israelites. And we begin the plagues. The 10 plagues. Verse 14 through 25 describe the first plague, the river that turns to blood and kills all the fish. Now, can you imagine a river with millions of fish and all the fish dying and the smell that would come from that? The sustenance they probably got from the fish, from eating the fish, beyond potential of drinking water or other forms of use. And Pharaoh would relent to their face. But then he would say, nope, I changed my mind. And he did that over and over. The second plague were frogs. A couple of frogs are cute. Not millions of frogs. That's not cute. That's pretty gross. And then the third plague, lice. And then there would be flies. Millions upon probably billions of flies everywhere. In Exodus 8, verse 22, it says, "In that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. I will make a difference between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall be." So again, we see a miracle. Only the plagues were affecting the Egyptians. There was a hedge put around the Israelites in Goshen, protecting them. Can you imagine looking past that point and seeing millions of locusts? So many locusts on the ground you couldn't walk because it covered the ground completely. But God was making a point. I am the all-powerful. I will protect my people. And the Egyptians are seeing this happen. In the fifth plague, we see that all livestock were diseased. All of the cattle, all of the horses, the mules, the donkeys were diseased. And then boils, the sixth plague, on man, not just man, but man and beast. And then the seventh plague, hail, but not your normal hail. Let's look in Exodus 9, verse 19. Exodus 9 and verse 19, it says, "Therefore send now and gather your livestock and all that you have in the field, for the hail shall come down on every man and every animal which is found in the field and is not brought home, and they shall die." It's not little hail. This is hail that kills people, that killed animals, large animals. So there was hail in verse 24, and not just hail, but fire mingled in with the hail, so very heavy that there was none like it in the land of Egypt since it became a nation. In verse 26, only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, there was no hail. There was no hail. Now we see, as already referenced before, locusts in the eighth plague, Exodus 10, verse 5. It says, "And they shall come to the face of the earth, so that no one will be able to see the earth, and they shall eat the residue of what is left, which remains to you from the hail, and they shall eat every tree which grows up for you out of the field." So the hail had undoubtedly probably destroyed much of the trees, and what was left, the locusts would eat. So they were decimating the land of the Egyptians. God was performing these miracles and making his point. Yet Pharaoh would not relent, even after all of that. The ninth plague was darkness. Let's look at Exodus 10, verse 21. "Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his or her place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings." Now that's quite a miracle that there was light in their dwellings, but not outside. I'm not sure how that could have worked, but it did. In 2017, you may remember the great solar eclipse that came right over this area. It was August 21st of 2017. It was a big deal because it came right over St. Louis and right through southern Illinois, and people were super excited to see about 3 minutes of no light. That was the lack of darkness. So you can imagine 3 days of eerily no light. It would have quite an impression of the power of the God of the Israelites. Yet Pharaoh said, okay, make it stop. And then when they left, he relented. He said, no, we're gonna put the pressure back on. They need to stay in captivity. So now we come to the 10th plague, one that would hit very, very deeply, and that was the death of the firstborn. Exodus 11, verse 1, "And the Lord said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he shall surely drive you out of here altogether. Speak now in the hearing of the people, and let every man ask from his neighbor and every woman from her neighbor articles of silver and articles of gold." Which probably sounded a little odd that, okay, we're going to ask them for their silver and gold, but this was part of the prophecy. Verse 3, "And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people." So So Moses had actually earned the respect of the Egyptians because of what they were seeing them accomplish, the miracles that they were witnessing. They knew that Moses was no joke, and the God of Moses was no joke. In verse 5, it says, then Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go out in the midst of Egypt, and then all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sits on the throne, even the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals." So not just the people, but also the animals. Then there in verse 6, "There shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor shall be like it again. But against none of the children of Israel shall a dog move its tongue, against man or beast, that you may know that the Lord does make a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. In verse 8, "And all these servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, Get out, and all the people who follow you. After that, I will go out." Then he went out from Pharaoh in great anger. So here, Pharaoh hears this and is angry. "Get out. Get out of my throne room. Get out of here. I don't want to hear about this anymore." But the Lord said to Moses, "Pharaoh will not heed you, so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt." So Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the children of Israel go out of his land. So now they'll pay the price. Step along the path number eight, and that is Passover symbolism and the physical to spiritual application. Passover symbolism and the physical to spiritual application. So Moses is the one to bring Passover into the application of the physical that we would then use the analogy to, obviously, the spiritual. In Exodus 12, verse 2, it says, "This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of persons, according to each man's need. You shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be," in verse 5, "without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight." So a sacrifice would occur, this physical sacrifice of the unblemished lamb. Verse 7, "And they shall take some of the blood, and it shall be placed on the doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with an unleavened bread and with bitter herbs, that they shall eat it." So here we see that the application of the process of Passover and what was to take place. If we go on down to verse 10, it says, "You shall let none of it remain until morning. And what remains of it until morning, you shall burn with fire. And thus you shall eat it, and with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." A couple of points to be made here, and that is that details matter to God. Details matter. It's not so much that we have to check the box, that we can do things physically, but our ability to practice and apply these things on an annual basis means that we're putting them just that, in practice. We're exercising those things, just as was talked about in the sermonette. It takes application. Following the annual holy days is important, and how we practice the Passover, how we unleaven our homes, how we understand the analogy of what that means to our lives and the character we are to create is important to God. Also note their preparedness. They were to be clothed and ready to eat in haste and to be able to basically head out. Just as we are to be spiritually ready now We are to be ready at all times because we don't know the hour or the time. So we must also be ready spiritually. Verse 14, so this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance, which is still what we practice today. Exodus 12, verse 15. So 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day, verse 16, there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared by you. And in verse 21, then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, pick out and take lambs for yourselves according to your families and kill the Passover lamb. So Moses here had been a leader. He was communicating, training, teaching these new practices to the elders of the nation of Israel. And they were understanding what God wanted from them. These specific processes to be followed. Because God was making a point. One of the points was that the Israelites were following the Israelite God, and they were not following the practices of the Egyptians. They were to be separate. Step along the path, number nine. Israel had to be obedient to save their own lives. Israel had to be obedient to save their own lives. In verse 22 of chapter 12, and you shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of this house until morning. So very specific instructions. They were to take the blood from the offering. They were to put it along the doorposts, along the lintels, and they were to not leave their home. Very strict. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your house to strike you. And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. And it will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. Verse 26, and it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service, that you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households. So the people bowed their heads and worshipped. They listened to the instruction and they followed with obedience. In verse 29, and it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. None were spared in Egypt. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. They didn't have electricity. It wasn't white noise. There wasn't a lot of insulation. They would be living near each other. They would hear the cries from home to home, seeing the dead in their homes and mourning. In verse 36, it says, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So how the tables turned. Through these miracles that God had to perform because of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, many would be killed, many suffered, and finally Pharaoh relented. In verse 40, and not just relented, but the Israelites then plundered the nation of Egypt. Now the sojourn, in verse 40, of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. You might call them spiritual armies because they weren't really prepared as a true army, but they were following God. They were following Moses and his instruction. In verse 42, it says, "It is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is the night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations." So we now practice these festivals, these holy days, as we're about to in the spring time frame. We see the analogy, the relevance for us today. And we're to remember and observe these times. We also know that with Christ's sacrifice, there is an understanding that we have now of how we practice Passover in the days of unleavened bread. But the symbolism is still the same. Walking with Moses again, point number 10 in that walk. The last point here. Remember the strength of the hand of God. Remember the strength of the hand of God. Because there will be times, maybe right now, when you wonder if God's hand is there. You might be waning in your faith. You might be wondering if God is truly there to help you. Well, I think you can see that God is there, but not always in the time we fully want him to be. But God's hand is the Almighty. It is the strength of God's hand that delivered the Israelites, as he will deliver us. Exodus 13, verse 3. This will be our last scriptures here in Exodus. In verse 3 it says, "And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month of Abib. And it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. Verse 6, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in the day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It's to be practiced. It's to be handed down from generation to generation, the remembrance of how the Lord delivered us. In verse 9, it shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year." Turn over now to Hebrews 11. As I mentioned before, Moses is the most mentioned figure from the Old Testament in the New Testament. Hebrews 11, as you're probably aware, is also the faith chapter. We've read this a number of times, but let's see what it says about Moses. Chapter 11 and verse 24 says, "By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure in Egypt, for he looked to the reward." Moses was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He undoubtedly would have had tremendous riches and favor that he turned away from. He walked away from. In verse 27, "By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him, capital H, who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned." The Egyptians were vanquished, as we know, in the Red Sea. There was, I'm sure, a great amount of fear as they were crossing the Red Sea, but they had just witnessed a miracle of the sea being opened. But God vanquished their enemy. There's a famous poem that you've probably read. I know we've read before, even during the messages, by Margaret Fishback Powers. The poem is Footprints in the Sand. I think it's applicable here, but one of the scriptures that actually they say she drew this poem from is related to this time period. If you would turn over to Psalms 77. Psalm 77. As we go through these verses, listen to the emotion that are in these verses and the trials that would have occurred that the Israelites had to go through to be delivered. Most likely the doubt that they would have had, that even Moses had at times. In verse 1 in Psalm 77, it says, I cried out to God with my voice. To God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained, and my spirit was overwhelmed. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Under so much stress and anxiety that you just can't get it out. Verse 5, I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever, and will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Many of these thoughts we may have had, we may question at times during great trials and anxiety. In verse 10 it says, And I said, This is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths also trembled. In verse 17, the clouds poured out water. The skies sent out a sound. Your arrows also flashed about. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Verse 19, your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So we see the deliverance, and we see that God at times was, in a way, carrying the Israelites through that sea, showing them miracle after miracle that he was their God and he would save them. In conclusion, the title of the sermon today was Walking with Moses and the many lessons we can learn from the life of a prophet. The greater lesson, though, today is, as we prepare for the spring holy days, is in our walk with God. What we saw from Moses and God was a relationship being built, a relationship like the one we need to be building now with God. It will have its ups and downs. Moses would doubt himself. He would get angry. He would be upset with himself, with the Israelites, and want the burden of leading a people that at times he probably just wanted to walk away from. We are today God's spiritual Israel. Now, are you wanting to be led by God? Are you developing the character to be led, and are we building a relationship with God that is encouraging to us and to him? He greatly desires to call us his children and to lead us to his promised land. Let us hold tight to our calling and walk with God along the path he chooses.